With Harold Campbell, we're talking in his office in McArdle Lab. The date is May 10th, 1983. This is Laura Smale.
I have to program in my own personal computer.
Uh-huh.
They're tremendous computers.
Your head, yes.
As you well know, with people have kind of tried to preempt that name recently, but they, I think they kind of misuse it. My own personal computer, half time, and the other machine, and I could do half it and then put it in and do it on it. And I was, about a year ago, we up to that point. And been actually a year and a half going from what is the logic required to get from two dimension into a three dimension plot. And it's not, you just can't treat it as though it were a single change. It requires a new and extended logic. You talk about biology, and then you get microbiology, bacterium, and then you get to molecular biology. Again, a little, that you can't use the same logic all the way through. Mm-hmm. So it happens here too, and go from one to two to three. It requires a different logic to interpret the data. And it's the logic, can we figure out how to do it in your personal computer is required first.
Yeah.
After you can do it and figure out this is the logic required, then it's a matter of coding and instructing, writing instructions for the computer to do it so that the user can, without going spending that time and developing it in a personal computer, be able to get the answers. And also, so you can crank them out quick, fast.
Yeah.
We're going to crank out thousands of these before July 30th. We must, because we have to get a big enough data bank to, so statistically it has some meaning.
And nobody had done this before.
Didn't even do a single.
This
is cutting edge.
This is the single. This article is about the single application.
One change only.
Uh-huh.
And the logic required to carry this out for one change only. I say no one ever did it before, you know, and did nothing new under the sun. On the other hand, you know, it's also the same. There was one sharer in Emlat over in Switzerland did a very small piece of this some 10 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
It's true, we don't start from scratch. None of us do.
No, I guess
none
that's
of us
true.
Do.
What, and if you had to describe this in terms for a layman, what would you say it is what did you say yesterday was the final? You finished it for this morning. How would you describe it?
I didn't quite.
Well, this what you've been working on and what you have finished and what now has
right.
to be put to the
right.
practical application.
Right.
How would you say it? The tape recorder is on. How would you describe it to a layman? Not the whole process, but what it is you've done.
It is a method which we have now put on a computer because the computations are so lengthy and tedious that it takes more than one lifetime to get much data. If we had to calculate by hand or even a hand calculator, and the logic required is probably the part that I like to be identified with, because that is often the thing that's missing. If we don't have a logic to achieve something, we just can't do it. So what we did first was to, and have published in this publication here of Campbell, Pito, Potter, and Lacius, describe the logic required to interpret data when we have available only a two-dimension picture through the liver of changes, and these are enzyme changes in the cells before they have changed sufficiently so that there's any shape or morphology change, so that the pathologist cannot recognize them as being abnormal cells, like the pathologist recognizes a frank tumor cell, but the changes are precancerous it's difficult to prove, but the sequence seems to be consistent with that when these changes take place, soon thereafter, the frank cancer condition shows up.
Yeah.
So it's you have circumstantial evidence, but you can't say this one little cell, and then we found it to be a cancer, because once you kill the rat, it's killed, and you can't do it a second time. So, but it is quite consistent that these are precancerous conditions, these enzyme changes. We can see these enzyme changes if we can stain using histochemical staining, which will, a stain will stain for the end product of the enzyme. So if the enzyme is present, and then we stain it, so the product of that enzyme is red, then we go and look for red. We don't see the enzyme itself, but we see its product.
Mm-hmm.
So if the cell had that enzyme in great excess compared to the normal, it would show up as a red spot. We do this not only for one enzyme, we do it for a group of enzymes. Important enzymes in the biochemistry of the liver. We're working with liver. And after we do this, taking a slice about a fifth of a cell diameter in thickness, we then can take a second cell slice and have the same cell asking the same question, but we can't stain it with two stains or they interfere with one another. So we can ask it for one stain, and ask for the second question, ask it for the third question. But now this is still just a two-dimension picture of a three-dimension liver and three-dimension world. So we don't know when we see a small spot whether we have cut through a large group of cells with this characteristic, or just a very small one, or maybe it really only was a few cells. There's no way to know this just by looking through a microscope and seeing how big the red spot was. This is the dilemma, has been, and it has in the past been, well, just tabulated and say, well, we saw so many red spots and so many little spots and so many big spots. The opportunity then, as an old chemical engineer like myself, is to recognize that that has only limited validity or usefulness, because it cannot describe what's going on in the liver itself. And not only that, next thing, to recognize that something is not true or not valid has some value, saves us making some mistakes. But until you can say, yes, and this is the way it can be done, we haven't made a great leap forward. This then is a challenge to a person like me with logic. I say, what is the logic required to get that from two-dimension observations to a situation consistent with those two-dimension observation in the three-dimension space of the liver, which is a matter of dealing mathematically with the area of geometric probability. What is the probability of hitting an object in the center and off-center, putting all these together, and then reconstructing, not reconstructing is probably the wrong word, to constructing in a probabilistic manner. What is probabilistically the situation in three-dimension space that would give this two-dimension data? It's a field that is known as quantitative sterology. It has been quite highly developed, very highly developed, in the field of metallography. Hmm. I'm an old chemical engineer, and I come to it having some experience in metallography, so my mind is pre-programmed. So you say, this is the problem, who might have had a similar situation? And the happy thought was, I'm not the first one that ever had the problem, maybe the first one ever tried to solve on the liver, but this situation must have been elsewhere. And working as a machinist on a Bridgeport mill, making metal parts to build a machine to produce mountain climbing equipment, a small company that my son owns, and I act as a machinist, said, the material I'm using here is part of a throwaway, part of a throwaway test casting. We cast this and then saw it in half and polish it, and we look at it, and the problem is the same as if we were looking at a slice of a liver, because we only see the top edge.
Yeah.
So I said, let's go back and ask the metallographers and see how it can be done in metallography, because there's no merit in making these test castings and sawing this in half unless we could get some good data out of it. They could get some good data out of it. So I snooped this out. It's not readily described as such in the library, but finally found a man that I knew, a graduate PhD from metallurgy over here, a metallography, and I said, Ron, how do you do it? He said, well, I didn't have to do it, but I know there's a book that describes how to do it. So I said, well, what is the name of the book? The book is Quantitative Metallography. Who wrote it? So I forget the name, but it's right over in the library by the Union South. So I went over there, and there is no such book in the card index. So it's a story of all our life. I mean, so what do you do? So I said, I bet you Ron was using a book from a professor of his, probably in a professor's library, in a shelf somewhere. So I went down in the lunchroom and talked to the people and said, all right, fellas, you know Ron Kochi. Oh yeah, we know that guy. Well, this is what Ron told me. What professor might have such a book that Ron might be acquainted with? Well, you can imagine the argument and talking in a lunchroom with different students and PhD candidates and the like. And they finally argued one, argued another. Finally, one fellow said, Professor Perepesco, he's the one that would have it. He's the one. And they said, oh yeah, I'll bet you he is. Theoretical metallography. And I said, well, fine, where can I find him? He said, well, he's in a different department. This is an application metallography. Now you have to go into theoretical metallography. That's in that big building over in the next block. Mm-hmm. So I went over to see and Professor Pierre Pascoon up on the 12th floor and knocked, as you know, Ron Coachy, yeah, I know him. I said, here's what Ron told me. What might he be talking about? He said, ah, the problem with Ron Coachy was that we used the word quantitative metallography when we're applying it in our own use. But the book is not titled Quantitative Metallography. The book is entitled Quantitative Stereology. Mm. But stereology, of course, you can see we apply to metallography in this particular book. And he says it's written by Professor Underwood. So with this approach, and he gave me a reference, I go down to the library and sure, we can find an elegant treatise on this field of how do the metallographers go about solving the problem of interpreting what goes on in a piece of steel when the only observations they obviously can make is right on the surface. This is no different than the one problem I was hoping to solve for Professor Pito. So now in applying this kind of thinking to our particular problem, we, about a year ago, have solved that and have published its application to our particular problem in histology stained liver slices. And in the last year and a half, I have spent carrying this a step further than used in metallography or in liver. By now, as I've described, applying it to situations where I have several alterations within the same cell and asking the question, can we solve the logic required for this situation, which is now 2, 3, 4 changes within a cell and superimposing mathematically, so we know, since we cannot see them morphologically, we can only see them after the stain, and we can only effectively make one stain at a time, superimpose these slices by matching up anatomical markers, blood vessels, so that we say we're speaking about a particular cell, it did or did not have the second, third stain. Yeah. And that's what we're about to apply in actually application, real data, this week for the first time, and hope and fully expect that within 3 months now, we'll be able to get enough data and get enough experience so we have assurance that we know how to interpret this data. Right now on computer simulation, where I can specify where the cells are and how big a group they are, where I have no experimental error at all, the logic which I have devised over the last year is holding up.
Yeah.
And a year ago I said to Pito, what we're doing on multiple phenotype, again, like I did year before that, on single phenotype, is not valid. What we need to do now is to go one step farther, but my problem is, at that time, I don't know how to do it. I think that's been pretty much a story of my life. I've been a problem solver rather than one carrying out experiments I knew how to run. I don't mean to badmouth those that run experiments, they know how to run. If they don't know how to do something better than that or more, out closer to the cutting edge, that's fine. But if you can get away from that, say this is a problem that is real for real people, we don't know how to do it, but with confidence in ourselves and those we can draw on around us, we believe we can figure out a way of getting the necessary data to solve it. You can stub your toe and fall flat in your face and maybe it's impossible. Sure. But on the other hand, some of the things I have done, I did when those around me would shake their head and say, well, you know, he's barking up a tree that he can't climb. Some of them I haven't climbed, but I assure you, some of them I have. And to go back on that, just to give a quick run through, I'm a product of Carl Paul Link's lab. I learned some of this problem solving from Carl. He wasn't running experiments he knew how to run. He often was, he and his students working on problems no one knew how to solve, experiments he didn't know how to do. And I pulled out, isolated, the material we now know as dicumeral. At that time was the sweet clover disease, the only thing we knew it by. I pulled that out. Others, Mark Stallman, produced more of it after I had isolated the material, produced more of it. Charlie Huebner, the sharpest organic chemist that I remember in Carl's lab, solved what it was chemically. Both Charlie Huebner and Mark Stallman then set about and made some, synthesized it, to be sure that the synthetic material was the same material as Campy had isolated out of the sweet clover, and it was. Then, like the three-legged milk stool, in this case it's a five-legged stool. The symbolism doesn't quite carry the same way, but the idea, the concept, if it is essential, it's essential. No point in talking about how essential is this to the outcome. That's a misnomer. It's self-inconsistent. If it's essential, it's essential. There is five things essential to that discovery. And the patent is often a lot more honest than publications. Publications, people get their name on for honorary reasons or for political reasons or other reasons, and left off for the same reasons. Mm-hmm. But on a patent, if you leave a name off and anybody finds it out, it's invalid. It can be proven invalid. And you can't enforce it. If you put a person's name on for honorary reasons, because he was the boss, and anybody can finds it out or suspects it, the patent can be proved invalid. The people there must make honest and solid contributions to the full concept, or error either way is lost. So a patent often reads more honestly of really who made contributions rather than who talked about it. On those patents, dicumeral, application of dicumeral for the decrease of clotting time of an animal, it's a process patent. Those patents are Carl Paul Link, H.A. Campbell, Mark Stallman, Charlie Huebner, and Ralph Overman. Each one in their own right, like on a table, each one holding up his own corner. Mm. making a solid contribution to the end result, and without any one of them, the end result didn't happen. I was going to say wouldn't have, you know, you could substitute names for someone else and so on. Didn't happen is the right word. And that is the situation there in Carl's lab on dichumero. I made my contribution of isolating, obtaining from toxic sweet clover hay the pure crystalline material. That was my contribution. Others made, as I mentioned, their contribution. Mark Stallman producing more of it after I left.
Did you name it? Or was it already?
No, after we got a crystalline material, just a few nice little crystals, like a little pile of sugar in your hand, no one knows what his name is. We just know what we just got, that little pile of stuff. It wasn't until this chemistry, its identity, chemical identity was known, that a name could be applied, and lo and behold, it not only didn't require naming, it was known in the literature and described by a chemist way back in Germany at one time, working on coumarins, and its name becomes obvious once you know its chemistry. That is its chemical name. Mm. Now you can apply trick names thereafter, like aspirin. That's not a chemical name, but its chemical name is quite different. But you can apply trick name like warfarin or coumadin and things like that. And dicoumarol is a trick name of that type. Knowing its organic structure, it was decided to call it dicoumarol. I was not part of the naming somatics. My specialty has never been somatics. My specialty has been as an actor player, not a spectator of doing original creative research right up on the cutting edge. That's where I get my kick. That's where I got that from the University of Illinois, where Speed Marvel, Schreiner, Fasan, organicers down there, got this young guy, Kempe, coming through their organic department and caught him on fire. The excitement of making discovery, real discoveries, not just talking about them. And then I came up here to Wisconsin and Carl picked me up because he had asked Homer Atkins if there was an applicant came in on organic chemistry to Homer Atkins, head of the organic department, that he didn't have room for. Carl says, if you see a good one over there, and I brag when I say that, at least both the gang down in Illinois that I'm product of wrote to their counterpart in Wisconsin because they didn't have a location for me there. Matter of fact, it was a policy that they didn't carry on their own students. If I hadn't learned what they had to offer at Illinois, in 4 years, it isn't likely that another 4 years I'd catch on. So I'd either head it and move on, or we'll move out. And he said, but I got a friend up at Wisconsin, Homer Atkins, that I've done favors for him. He'll do a favor for me. I'll write to him and see if you... So he wrote to Homer Atkins, and Homer Atkins didn't have a location. He called up Carl Paul Link and said, Carl, I got this guy. I sent his application over. Carl gave me the job without ever seeing me, just on say-so. I said, if he comes out of Illinois, out of that gang down there of organic chemistry, and he's been to Carl Miner up in Chicago, and Carl Miner is an industrial chemist at Chicago that Carl knew well in starch work. Carl Miner knew me because I had run analytical work in bakeries in order to make enough money to hang on to school. And Carl Miner and told Carl Link that yes, he knew me. So Carl led, sight unseen, Carl gave me the fellowship, $50 a month for work on his lab.
What year was that? That you came?
35. I was there 35 to 39.
Uh-huh.
And when I arrived, to come in the door, and Carl said, what's your name? And I said, my name is Harold Campbell. Oh, yeah, I expect you. We got too many Harolds here already. We'll call you Campy. Well, since that period, I've been known technically and to my friends as Campy. The only one that that calls me Harold recently is my mother, and she's now dead, so don't respond quickly to the name Harold for some years. But those that know me as Campy Campbell, and Carl knew me as Campy Campbell. This is true. There was four in Carl's lab at that time. All their first names were Harold. He said, that's too many.
Coincidence, yeah.
So Dykumo was one that I like to be identified with, isolation. Another one is, besides industrial work, General Foods. I have a lot of things there that I achieve. Such things as discovery of method of making minute rice and things like that, as well as soluble coffee, instant coffee, and so on. But there, this is a application of the same kind of expertise, same kind of, well, expertise is a fancy word, some just inquisitiveness. Can we do it? Problem solving. If we want to make soluble coffee, and soluble coffee is hard to do because it goes off flavor, how do we do it? Organic chemistry, biochemistry, everything wrapped together. The problem is no different than Dykumo, just on a different product. And I've often been asked, well, didn't you feel very, oppressed by not working in pure science in General Foods? And the answer, no, of course not. They have never understand and don't understand that the problem of solving what is in sweet clover disease for the farmer, one might perceive this as being high-level theoretical chemistry or pure science. But the kind of mentality required, the kind of problem solving required, is the same if you're going to solve it. Now, you can do experiments on things and not have that kind of mentality or orientation. True, maybe that's pure science, but again, the ones that have solved things, accomplished new things, like the antibiotics, penicillin, those kind of breakthrough advances, been people are working on real problems, they didn't know how to solve them. But they had confidence enough and ability enough and agile enough to work around and find them. And this kind of finding is what I would like to be identified with, Dykumo. The next one was mentioned here, and I'll pass on, the chemical identification of the vitamin niacin. I did that with conielvium. Not that I did all of the legs on the three-legged stool on Dykumo. I mentioned there's five of them.
Yes.
On niacin, the vitamin anti-pellagra factor, we knew it as the PP factor because that's the only thing we knew. Pellagra preventative factor, PP factor. On that one, I did the identification. Elvium brought me the little crystals, and I determined what that was chemically, and that is, for the record, published back then. That's a different kind of a skill required, an analytical skill. There it comes back to me as an analyst, back before Carl ever caught me, oriented to how do you, as an analyst, analyze something accurately enough and able to interpret the result. Not just get the numbers. Lots of people can get the numbers. But interpret those numbers in real problem-solving way. It is niacin, nicotinic acid. We now needn't have people dying of pellagra. Number two. Number three is, after working with General Foods from 22 years, I then went back to, for fun, the excitement of discovery and medical research, Sloan Kettering. Sloan Kettering Institute of Cancer Research, where I spent about 12 years there with another team of five of us. Myself, the biochemist supplying biochemical thinking and preparation, the immunologist Lloyd Old, the geneticist Ted Boyce. After all, we didn't want to trip our toes in just having an artifact, not a genetic novelty. Herb Erickson, the bedside clinician, the treatment of childhood leukemia by the enzyme L-asparaginase, number three. It is in application now to pharmaceutical product. In a pharmacy, you can find niacin, you can find dicromoral, you can find L-asparaginase. Thousands of people now continue to walk that wouldn't otherwise walk, having had the benefit of each one of those three, each one in an entirely different field, each one with an entirely different approach. I haven't just had a little red wagon and then piled another bag of sugar on it and carried it. Each one requiring a different approach. One isolation and dichromoral, one identification and niacin, and on at Sloan Kettering Institute of Cancer Research, New York City, quite a different thing applying to cancer, and how now do we produce and isolate enough material, biological material. We got this out of the lowly E. coli, the L-asparaginase. Looking for L-asparaginase, that an enzyme which people might not be too immune reactive to. After all, you and I, we all have made our peace with the little intestinal flora, E. coli. And he also has L-asparaginase, isolated from L-asparaginase. This is the biological material which is now used for the treatment of childhood leukemia in the routine of several other materials, one in the rotation. When the individual becomes resistant to one, you use the second, you do the third. It's in a rotation of 3 to 5, depending on the doctor's preference. And this is, you have read and recognized, probably the most successful cancers that we can now treat are the leukemias treated this way. Number three. Number four is here with Pito. Again, not looking for a treatment, not trying to help the farmer whose cow was dying by hemorrhage, sweet clover disease, not the person dying of pellagra because he didn't have niacin, not the child in there with leukemia that we could clobber with L-asparaginase because the cell we knew could not make his own, but a normal cell could. So we clobber him in 3-5 days, send him home clinically, or at least remission. And with a rotation, some of them may be permanently cured. Hasn't been around that long. I don't know if we've permanently cured anybody, because until the individual gets 72 years life expectancy, we don't know.
Of course not.
But they're still walking around free, see? Here with Pito, is not on a cure, not a treatment of a disease. Here with Pito, I'm working on, can we understand how this comes about? There's no assurance that understanding may automatically lead to a cure and treatment. But without understanding, we're unlikely to find a cure or treatment. And is that at this stage now, on a understanding of what's going on, with Pito, we're stepping back one step. Pito doing the biology, pathology, the trained pathology, top pathologist, and I helping Pito with his numbers, his mathematics. Quite a different role, quite a different situation, quite a different challenge to me. Can we do it? Working on things that we don't know the answers to, but you know, with some good fortune, had much good fortune. Good fortune, some flexibility, find some answers, and that's what we're up to.
Where did you learn to work with numbers if you were a chemist, an organic chemist?
I came to University of Illinois as an electrical engineer. My father was a contractor, a bricklayer, and I was headed for contracting. I was going to be a contractor like my father. My father didn't know his electrical engineering or house wiring like. I took up house wiring in high school. I was went to University of Illinois as electrical engineer. Had a course in chemistry and I liked it. So I thought, well, maybe I'll be a engineering chemistry. So I got into the engineering department, but with chemistry. I still liked my chemistry, so I moved over to another department in the chemistry department, which is engineering chemistry, which is more chemistry and less engineering at that point. When I came up to getting my degree, Speed Marvel, head of organic down there, said, Kempe, you're going to have to make up your mind. This is your last year. You've been straddling this, you've been taking engineering, you've been taking organic. Are you going to finish up as a organic chemist, or are you going to as a chemical engineer? I said, well, can I take an original thesis in organic research if I finish up as a chemical engineer? And he said, no. If you want to be an organic chemist, then you can have that, or you can finish up as an engineer. I had that choice. I was up to one course. They were given at the same time, and I couldn't take both of them at the same time. So I decided I was going to be an organicer. But I was hooked by that time on the excitement of discovery. Not just chemistry, not just the textbook, not just theories, but the discovery right at the bench, discovering something new. And in those days, we could, I was a pretty irregular student. After all, it took me 7 years to get my BS degree from out of high school. But again, I had a lot of remedial work to do in the meantime, and had to take some time out to get a little money to stay in school. By doing research there as an undergraduate under Schreiner in quantitative organic chemistry. Again, I've always had an inclination to the quantitative mathematical end, all the way back to my engineering. You don't have to be one or the other. I was the most maverick misfit when Speed, I said, one Sunday morning there working in the lab, Marvel came in and said, Campy, what? I misspoke there. He didn't call me Campy because I wasn't dubbed as Campy until I got here to Wisconsin. Campbell, he said, how's things going? And I said, well, I'm going to get out in June. This should be in March, something like this. So I need a job. Will you give me a fellowship here? He said, oh, no. Well, this printer laid me on the floor. I said, Professor, I'm an undergraduate, you know, and I hold my own. I took your course in advanced organic last semester, and I got a good grade. Well, I know you got a good grade. And I did as well as all those PhDs that had come in from other schools. He said, oh, you missed the point. Of course, I expect my own students to be smarter than those guys coming in from the outside. But you've been here 4 years. You got our philosophy? Or if you haven't got it by this time, you're not about to get it. It's time to go on. He says, time to take your master's on the East Coast and your PhD on the West Coast. Or you can turn them around. But he says, turn around. But he said, I had missed you. I had forgotten. I didn't realize you were coming up this semester because you're so irregular. Sure, I was in there irregular, so, you know, most irregular student he can imagine, or I can imagine. And, but he says, I'll see what I can do. And that's, he said, it's too late. After all, most schools close their applications April 1st or something like that. He said, after all, it's too late. But he said, I had this friend up there, Homer Adkins, and I tied back to my previous story on that. That's when he got me out of there. But I have not been an organic chemist. I've not been an engineer. I've not been a lot of things. I've been a maverick, a jack of all trades. Not quite, but my mind has ranged widely. And when it comes down to this problem here with Pito, it's doubtful I would have been able to solve it or known where to look. Others haven't. Without my rather scattered or checkered maverick background. You asked about where did I get my mathematics? I got my mathematics back from my father as a contractor figuring out how much it's going to cost to make a fireplace. Interested in mathematics ever since. But I studied my mathematics ever since, too. Not that one is good and one's bad. You can't do all things, but I've been interested in mathematics. But I'm not a medic either. If you become a medic, a heart surgeon, if you're going to concentrate there, you probably don't have time to concentrate on being a and your mathematics too. Many of them don't, and they're lost. They can't do all things, I can't do all things, but I do have certain things I can do, and I have devoted my life to it. The last 20 years I've used what life savings my wife and I had saved while I worked for General Foods, because I don't do this kind of research. I'm not funded, not just paid researcher, along with Social Security and life savings. I'm enjoying doing medical research, discovery. That's fine. But those are the areas that we worked on. Those four. This one included. Brings me up to date.
Didn't you get anything on the patent?
Yes, I got something on the patent. The patent of the Wisconsin Alumni Foundation returns 15% to the inventors, as you well know. And there's four of us, and so I got on the patent 1/4 of 15%. That was not big money. Has paid my whiskey bill over the years. I received a check even after coming back to Wisconsin this time on the patent. It was just finished up. The largest amount I ever received on the patent was I believe $2,700 for the year.
I thought it was a lot of money that one. Oh, you got 1/4 of 15%.
Right.
I see.
All four of our names there, all four of us made the contribution, all four of us get 1/4 of 15%. The patent, Takumro patent, did not pay a great deal of money. The warfarin pattern, which warfarin being devised after dicumarol, pattern after dicumarol, leaving a little bit of the molecule off, and that has, there was a lot more return from the warfarin pattern, patent, and I'm not part of the warfarin pattern, as you well recognize. It's the dicumarol pattern. Patent that I am party to, and warfarin was a offshoot from. Now we know dicumarol, we know what it'll do. Then Carl turned a group of students loose on him, say, leave this piece off, leave this piece off, leave this piece off. We'll test each one and see what piece we can leave off and still get physiological activity. And in that approach, I don't know, some 40 or 50 compounds were produced, and one of them that seemed favorable and is cheaper to make and so on by leaving one of the coumarins off, replacing it with a benzene group and a acetic acid group, still has a good activity, a little different activity than dicumarol, although not much different. They both used on people. They both are, matter of fact, maybe the, well, we don't like to tell a person we're going to treat them with rat poison. Eisenhower received Coumadin. He didn't receive dicumarol. He received the rat poison. Well, most people don't like that, so it's a nicety. We rename it, and when you use that same chemical, identical same chemical, in a person, we say, we're going to give you Coumadin, which is fine, and it's good. It has a little different characteristic. I think probably the most important difference in the characteristic depends on what the particular physician is experienced with. After leaving Wisconsin here, I went with General Foods, I mentioned the East. Back in the East, I spent my Saturdays and Sundays with Professor Shapiro. Shapiro being in the cardiac department of New York Medical School there in Manhattan. Come Saturdays and Sundays, I was in there with Shep treating people with dicumarol, the very early ones. These are early trials. First trial being here with Myers, the second one with Mayo Clinic, and then Shapiro, Campbell, and Roderick then started a good deal of work there in New York Medical School, and on Saturdays and Sundays, sometimes during the week when Shep got into trouble, or his patient got into trouble, Campy, can you come over right now? I can't hardly hold myself. I come over, and I was fortunate being in research in General Foods, where you can research often, can wait until a researcher has no respect for time a day or day. So as long as I'm doing the job, I could do it on a Monday or a Tuesday, and often did in those early days. And we applied in the early days now use of dicumarol or Coumadin to application of patients, people, and that is published in the names of Shapiro, Campbell, Roderick, and that group, which was an application. That's after, say, Mark Stahlman had produced, following my instructions of isolation, more of the material. Charlie Huebner jumped with his organic chemistry. Identified the breakdown products, and from the breakdown products could mentally put these, if these are the breakdown products, this is much, must be what they were, it was before we broke it down. In his mind, recombined it, then Mark and Charlie Huebner said, all right, if that's it, we will make some of that stuff and see if it's the same. It was the same, and at that point, knowing the chemistry of it, Lilly was interested in producing first material used for application to people. And it was Lilly material that we were using there in Bellevue Hospital, part of New York Medical School, putting it in.
Ikawa, isn't that his name? A Japanese, wasn't he in on that patent, that warfarin patent?
He might be in on the warfarin patent.
You don't know.
That was after, that's after I got out.
Mm.
All the warfarin comes after I get out, when they say, what can we leave off?
Why were they leaving something, why did they want to leave something off?
Well, you had no reason to believe that the, or for me to believe, that a material produced by apparently some microorganism in sweet clover that caused the cow to die of hemorrhage would be the optimum material to treat someone. It's quite obvious, and I've heard people ask me this question, and it's hard for me to give an answer. So, Campy, isn't it remarkable that when you found what was killing cattle on a Wisconsin farm, lo and behold, isn't it very remarkable that it now can be used in therapy for human medicine? And I, at this point, you know, I'm just floored. I have to be all indiscreet and say, you so-and-so, don't you give us credit for having any sense at all? What the hell do you think we were doing? Why the hell do you think I worked nights and days and so excited about pulling this thing out? And now you say, isn't it remarkable to have something to do with human therapy? It's true. I was trying to find out, because sweet clover is the only thing I had to work on. But don't you give us credit for having a little bit of sense to realize that if we can find out what kills the cow with hemorrhage because the blood won't clot or won't clot fast enough, that if we could ever find that out, this is what we would like to have when a person is dying of a blood clot. I said, give us a little bit of common sense. That's what the hell we were working on. For $50 a month, I wasn't surviving. And it's true, it would be a nice thing for the farmer, but the only farmer had his problem solved. He didn't have to make sweet clover hay. He could make hay out of things other than sweet clover. We're going to make much difference to the farmer, and I'm not going to help the cow that died. That's what it's all about. But that's that kind of perspective. Not just running experiments we know how to run. There's too much of that. Not just doing the experiment that we know how to do. But these are real problems of society and the world and people, particularly people. Why did I come into, why did I get out of engineering? After I got out of University of Illinois as almost an engineer, just a flip of the coin, I could have been either one, and organic, I said, what do I want to apply? My arithmetic, my understanding of numbers, engineering, and my understanding of organic chemistry, how things are put together and how to make them. I could apply it to rocks. You know, I could apply it to making steel. I could apply it to a lot of things. But the important thing, I came to the conclusion, the important thing for me to apply it to now would be people things, people-oriented things. Now, that is probably rewriting history somewhat. We all do it. I do it. I'm not, of course. I already told you I came into Carl's lab probably not by my choice, but by his. But, and by happenstance at that. True. But at this point, you catch fire with the situation. Say, all right, now if we can apply our arithmetic and our organic chemistry and my analytical yen or inclination all together to solving real problems for people problems, not rock problems or table problems, real people problems, this is where I want to give my thrust. It's that kind of trust. I might break my arm someday, patting myself on the back, but again, if I be so mild and so retiring that I don't even speak out, who is going to know about it?
Was this Carl Pauling's reason for working also?
Yes. Yes, very definitely. I learned a lot of this from Carl Pauling. Carl Pauling was a tremendous teacher. He's a mosaic. You get some funny pictures from a lot of different funny people. He's a mosaic. But, yes.